Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast, a show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the November 17th, 2020 edition of the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is your host, Todd Zempel, and I have with me Joe Gordon. Today we have a very special edition of the podcast. We invited a good friend of the firm, James Abate. James is Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Center Asset Management. James is also a fund manager on the American Select Equity and Global Listed and Infrastructure Funds. If you want more information on James, his background, his firm, you can check it out at centerasset.com. So with that, let's go ahead and kick it off. James, what are your general thoughts on the market and direction currently?
Well, I think where we are, you know, moving forward is that if you look at the market's current leadership stocks in general, you know, meaning the FANGs and some of the other growth areas of the market, they're extremely expensive when looking at traditional valuation metrics such as price to sales or price to cash flow. And, you know, the implied growth rates as we calculate them of future earnings are well in excess of even the halcyon period of double-digit growth that we've experienced or they've experienced over the last 5 years. Now, on the other hand, many of the cyclical industries where we've seen the stock prices of these companies move very sharply ahead over the past few months in anticipation of better sales growth and profit margin recoveries have moved themselves to levels where perhaps their upside, you know, in essence, what's not priced into the stocks leaves very little room for delay or underachievement. So we think we're at a point now where markets are, you know, somewhat fragile. They're very much dependent upon one or two things happening. One is either a very strong growth resurgence, which would further benefit cyclical areas of the market, or a continuation of Federal Reserve policies and other dynamics, risk appetite changes that would somehow take already, you know, excessively rich levels of valuation multiples even higher. So we think we're in a point in time, which is good for active stock selection, in that we're finally, I think, at a point in time where we're going to start to see, I would like to think, you know, unprecedented heterogeneity within the markets, and it's genuinely going to be an opportunity for active managers such as ourselves to demonstrate a high degree of stock selection alpha, which frankly might be the only source of return going forward over the next 12 months.
Yeah, so James, recently a Wall Street Journal article lumped your fund, the Center American Select Equity Fund, as one of the top performing large blend funds. I think the data was from Morningstar, if I'm not correct. What is it you do differently than the regular long only large cap blend funds?
Right. So thank you for pointing that out. And yes, it's been the third time this year, knock on wood, that we've been able to distinguish ourselves as one of the top Wall Street category kings in the Wall Street Journal. Now, for the category large cap blend, and what makes us differentiated is there's a few things. First and foremost is the Center American Select Equity Fund is a concentrated portfolio. So we look at basically holding between 40 to 55 stocks in the portfolio. Currently, we own 39 securities in the portfolio. And the other issue, which is very important, which is we let the bottom-up research dictate the tilt, you know, stylistically, or the proportion of growth and value stocks that we have within the portfolio. And that leads to a very high active share traditionally in the portfolio. And I think the other components that are critical is not just focusing the portfolio on stock selection, but also having a very detailed and crisp understanding of portfolio construction and risk management. And that combines basically stock position sizing with sector and industry emphasis, but it also brings into play our ability to introduce capital protective strategies when they're deemed appropriate. Everything for us starts with basically an investment objective. And our investment objective is to offer a risk-managed core growth fund, which can give, in essence, over a long period of time, market-like upside or returns, but with a diminished level of risk and volatility. And we try to bring all aspects of discipline to basically the process in trying to achieve that. So with regard to our distinguishment in the Wall Street Journal and other points in time, in the category kings and star ratings and so forth from Morningstar, you know, the real key for us has been able to navigate a dynamic market in 2020, where we have, in essence, been able to exhibit the characteristics that we have demonstrated on the label to our investors over a long period of time, which is to basically give investors a lower drawdown during stress periods, lower volatility, but also, as demonstrated in the second quarter's rebound, you know, actually give full market participation on the upside.
Very good. So comment a little bit about the risk mitigation and how you introduced buying put options to protect the downside.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, before I touch on the overlay with regard to put options, I do want to just emphasize again the point that it's a very important aspect of portfolio management holistically to not just identify good stocks. The real key is to identify alpha opportunities at the stock level, but then also recognize what each individual stock's contribution to the portfolio's overall volatility will be. Meaning, just like investors when they're investing in multiple funds, if they have a higher risk fund, they tend to weight that fund a little bit lower than let's call a stable blue chip fund in their overall portfolio. Think about it no different than when we look at individual stocks. We're looking at how stable is that stock, not just from a beta perspective, because I think that's overly simple, but understand, you know, the nuances of cyclicality in the business, the valuation point, because at certain points in time, stocks, when they reach trough valuations, have what I would consider asymmetrical beta to the market because they have a floor of valuation that is, supports them in terms of downside protection. So we spend a lot of time on position sizing to determine what we will do in terms of, you know, delivering that overall risk objective. Now, the third component, as we talked about, stock selection, position sizing, and then again, risk mitigation techniques through capital protective option purchases is we will look at the level of cost that an option will bear on the overall portfolio. Typically, that's associated with the VIX index. So what we try to be is buyers of optionality and protection of deep and sharp drawdowns on the market when volatility is relatively inexpensive, meaning the options are relatively inexpensive. A good rule of thumb is that we would be more aggressive in terms of the notional amount of the underlying investments that we protect when the VIX index is below 20, because it enables us to actually buy options at a much cheaper price and be less of a drag on the overall portfolio. And again, not to oversimplify things, tend to be a seller of options when the volatility index or the VIX index goes over 35, like in Kasich's point would be August of 2015, the early parts of 2018 and 2019. And then this past, obviously February and March period where the VIX got, all the way up to 85. Now, this is where a point, and this is important in the sense that I've been managing money for, over 25 years at Credit Suisse, at GAM, and now at Center Asset Management. So there are points in time where one has to appreciate and have a pragmatic approach to the market and recognize that, you know, sometimes things are a little bit different. I think we have in our business become so rigid and mathematically oriented and beholden to deductive spreadsheet modeling, and have lost a lot of just inductive, judgmental, experience, essentially. So one of the things that served us well is that even when the VIX index went through 35 and the options which we had purchased in the earlier part of the year, you know, when the VIX was below 20, went up past 35, we in essence kept the put option position on for a longer period of time and waited for actually the S&P to cross through the strike price on our deep out of the money put options before we were a seller. And obviously when volatility exploded to levels that we haven't seen since 1987, we felt it was prudent to actually exit any kind of option position on the portfolio in entirety, A, because the price of the option was, exceptionally rewarding and beneficial to shareholders. But more importantly, it gets back to, you know, the component of looking at valuation for the overall market. And one of the tools that we use is what we consider the market implied growth rate. That is, how is the market currently pricing the expected growth of earnings based on, the current stock price, capital structure, and so forth. And we do it typically on the average company in the S&P 500 or the equal weighted S&P 500. And frankly, when markets corrected to the degree they did, we saw the market implied growth rate on the market as a whole go back to levels where we were comfortable actually taking any type of put option or purchase put option off the portfolio. And it's only recently, actually last week, when markets have spiked on the news of the vaccine and we've seen volatility come way in, is when we've actually reintroduced put option overlay on the portfolio up to the market systemic risk that we foresee in the portfolio. And let me just step back, if I may, to talk about that. So the portfolio will be hedged either zero based or the second trigger would be the market level of risk, which, not to get too technical here, is you can think about every single portfolio having three components of risk: market risk, sector risk, and then stock specific risk. On average, portfolios tend to have around 50% market risk. So that's what we view as the systemic portion of the portfolio. Or if we are feel like options are very cheap and the market's extremely expensive and there's really very little opportunity, we'll actually put on 100% of the notional value of the underlying positions in terms of put options. Today, we've reintroduced the options, but have done so at the market systemic portion of the portfolio, about 50%, because even though we are bullish on a lot of the names that we own in the fund, obviously, with this rotation that's going on in the market, it's very hard for me to see, as I alluded to in my beginning comments, that 30% of the S&P 500, which is extremely overvalued, is somehow just simply going to deflate and not cause disruption to the overall market as well as other dynamics that are happening.
Yeah, thanks for that. So tell me, we've had this discussion previously. Why is it Morningstar? I think we used the word mislabels you, or why are you considered in the large blend category when in fact you have this option overlay program that you use?
I've spoken at great length with Morningstar, and the what you're pointing to specifically is whether or not the fund should be reclassified in the options-based category. And historically, the options-based category was mainly for option writing. That would be for funds that own the underlying, typically the S&P 500, and sold call options on individual positions. And it's now included funds that buy puts, sell puts, and do a lot of other things. And to be not to sound hubristic, but actually one of the problems that we have with Morningstar, and they've told me explicitly, is our performance has actually been too strong for the category because of our actual upside capture has been actually much higher, even though our downside capture is very consistent with that options-based Morningstar category. So I think we've kind of broken their little deductive spreadsheet there. So they continue to include us in the blend category. But most sophisticated investors who really dig down deep like yourselves, you know, appreciate what we're doing. And I think it highlights another point, if I may, is that one of the real problems that we've seen with other options-based managers over the past 5 years, actually, starting in August 2015, and really, you know, coming to the sunshine here in the February and March period of 2020, was the fact that a lot of strategies within that category buy long-dated put options on the S&P 500 or other indices, and then sell short-dated put options on the same index or use different strike prices. And I've been around in the business for a long period of time, and I frankly don't know how you can call yourself a fiduciary if you're actually selling put options, because in essence, you have unlimited risk. And we saw it in early 2019 and 2018, when we had the implosion of VIX and other things, where you saw mutual funds in essence go from an NAV of 10 to 1 and just simply get wiped out. Because what ended up happening this year for those types of strategies, just to educate your audience a little bit, is that yes, the long dated put option rose in price dramatically, but what ended up happening is that most of the gains in the long dated put option were offset almost fully by the losses, and significant losses, in the short dated options that were sold short, which have unlimited loss. So in essence, the whole benefit of hedging was completely wiped out, basically, by trying to arbitrage the price between long-dated put options that were purchased and shorter-dated put options that were sold short, which is why we would never, ever, you know, sell put options in the portfolio to try to partially offset the cost of our long-dated put options, which is why we try to be tactical and smart and try to understand what the cost benefit will be of undertaking the purchase put option, and go through kind of the process that we talked about with regard to the degree of option overlay that we want, because at the end of the day, it's a cost benefit exercise to appreciate to the protection of the underlying notional value of the fund.
Yeah, so I guess it would be fair to say the other competitors are a little short-sighted in the sense that they're adding volatility and increasing risk to the downside with that short writing, option writing strategy. And not naming any competitors, we've seen that it doesn't work, especially in this modern monetary theory of short-term volatility spikes. And then one way or another, the Fed or somebody saves you. But it's been persistent since, I think, around 2011. That we've been in that type environment. So let's move on a little bit to the core security selection process. Obviously, this has been a very strange year in the sense of we saw the 33% S&P 500 drop peak to trough back from mid to late February to March 24th, I think, was the bottom. And so can you just describe, using your process and just some examples of securities you've sold out of the portfolio this year, and then maybe a focus on a couple of your top holdings right now and why you like them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the reasons why we're able to kind of navigate this year successfully thus far is that we were, of the belief having entering the year was that you had an environment where, and it seems like forever ago, but at that point in time, as we enter 2020, the industrial side of the economy was in a recession, not really making much headway in terms of recovery, but the service economy was incredibly buoyant. We felt that things were unbalanced, and the consensus at that point in time was essentially that the industrial economy was going to catch up to the service economy. And we, based upon our bottoms-up research, weren't seeing basically that undertaking coming to fruition. So we were positioned relatively defensive with regard to traditional areas of the market where we were seeing opportunity, low degree of cyclicality, consumer staples, healthcare, some of the leadership technology stocks, and basically were void of most commodity areas of the market and, frankly, most cyclical areas of the market. Now, it's very important to point out, we don't make a top-down call and then try to fill up the portfolio to meet our designated buckets of where we are. You know, what we do is very much the opposite. It's essentially we're creating a mosaic of information that we share on a top-down perspective that's driven from our bottom-up analysis. In essence, what we're doing is we're focusing in on each individual company's outlook and their ability to create shareholder value. The concept that we use is called economic value added, or EVA. It's a concept that I've written a number of books on. In fact, the CFA Level 2 study material on the concept of EVA, or economic profit analysis, was authored by myself. And, you know, one of the things that we look at and what makes us different is that we're not just analyzing earnings, but we try to understand and link the capital allocation decisions that companies are making today and how they're going to lead to future earnings growth. In other words, you know, we're trying to find companies to invest in that they themselves are going to invest in productive assets of the business organically or through opportunistic purchases, or alternatively, if they can't invest in productive assets due to a cyclical downturn or excess capacity, we want them to wisely contract through restructuring of their assets and other resources to regain their footing, basically. So we very much had what we'd consider a stable kind of growth orientation in the beginning part of the year. Big names in the portfolio included names like Microsoft and Abbott, and, you know, other names that were very much part of that opportunity set that we're seeing on a bottoms-up perspective. Now, where we are today is that we have taken on a high degree of cyclical opportunity here. And this is really a key point because, you know, getting back to your very first question with regard to what differentiates us to other large blend or large core funds is, again, this ability to kind of identify opportunities that are not basically, you know, driven by this myopic focus on a style box by solely looking at EPS growth or accounting driven price to earnings and book multiples and momentum when it comes to growth or even value investing. You know, our approach, what we think, is much more pragmatic, and it recognizes that earnings growth can come from different sectors. And sometimes, like in early 2000, selling technology stocks based on valuation was the right thing to do. Or in the midst of the financial crisis and recession in 2009 or early 2010, you know, there's better investment opportunities in sectors that are out of favor or undergoing broad-based wise contraction as opposed to capital growth or stability. So we've been basically shifting and have been very active over the last few months, and in particular, much more so in the summer months, as we've been kind of harvesting some of these opportunities and letting them run, basically. So when you look at our top 10 holdings today versus at the beginning of the year, you won't see any pharmaceutical stocks, or you really won't see any, you know, broad-based consumer staples companies. You know, the top 10 is filled with, you know, our number four position is Barrick Gold, which is a position that we started to acquire in 2008 when the stock was below $10 a share. And we've seen the stock appreciate into the high 20s based upon a restructuring. ExxonMobil, which is the fifth top holding in the portfolio right now. We've just been a recent buyer of Exxon. We are very positive for the first time really since before 2014 on the energy sector. So some recent purchases that we've made in the energy sector include, you know, ExxonMobil, Kinder Morgan, Williams companies, and then very recently Apache and Cimarex Energy. Now, what all these companies have in common is that they, in essence, we've seen rig counts and other things just collapse to lows that we haven't seen since oil was below $10 a barrel in 1998. And what we're seeing now is companies wisely contract. They're getting rid of, you know, their growth plans. They're managing to pay down debt, sustain their dividends. And in essence, what we're seeing is that asymmetrical beta opportunity that I touched upon briefly earlier on. And, you know, I think that's across the board in a lot of commodity-oriented sectors right now. So I mentioned Barrick Gold, but also in the agricultural space, Bungie, which is one of the top 10 positions, as is Archer Daniels Midland. These are both recent purchases this year. We're seeing corn prices, soybean prices, crushing margins that are really impacting these companies, bottom out, starting to move much, much higher. So in essence, if you think about what we've done from a portfolio in a barbell kind of framework, is that over time, we will always have, in essence, a barbell, which will include, just because of the nature of looking at high return on capital businesses that have stable costs of capital, we're always going to have some kind of stable growth component of the portfolio, which would include some of the names like a Microsoft or an Abbott Laboratories or other names that tend to be in those areas of the market that provide a low degree of cyclicality and have sustainable growth that is a wide moat in kind of its protection to maintain high returns on capital above the cost of capital. The other part of the portfolio is that wisely contracting area, which is a very deep, what I call our contrarian component of the portfolio. And in essence, what we have done over the last few months is kind of slowly collapse that stable growth component to opportunistically fund purchases in the energy sector, in the chemical sector, names like Olin Chemical, Eastman Chemical. Those are names that we've been, tried to buy when yields were above 8.5%, almost near 10% in the case of, Olin. Names in the energy space, the agricultural space. So, right now, we didn't, again, go into this and say, okay, we want to have a lot of commodity-related exposure, a lot of cyclical exposure. What we're saying now is these stocks basically are trading at valuation levels that are generational lows in some cases. They're thoroughly hated in terms of any kind of momentum-based investors. We see sustainable yield, but most importantly, these companies are doing all the right things from a wealth creation standpoint by basically recognizing that they can actually grow shareholder wealth by contracting assets and essentially getting off of the wealth destruction a treadmill that destroyed a lot of wealth for these companies, particularly in the oil space, between 2010 and 2014. And we see a lot of opportunity on a bottom-up perspective in a lot of these commodity-oriented stocks and have been very tactical and market-oriented. And I'd like to say it demonstrates our pragmatism, kind of slowly kind of taking money off the table in stocks that we see reaching our valuation targets in the higher growth or more stable growth areas of the market.
Great, thanks. So wrapping up, let me ask you just a final question. Our firm acts plan level fiduciary, providing fiduciary governance to retirement plan committees, in addition to managing money for individuals and families on the wealth side. So what would you say to a 401k participant or a retirement plan committee as a unique selling proposition or statement of value, just to close up, when there's numerous studies in the industry that show that participants gladly would give up some upside in return for downside protection? So framing it that way, final comments.
Well, over my career, I think the one term that has been associated with the funds that I've managed over time, including now the Center American Select Equity Fund, is it's a large cap American equity fund that allows investors to eat well and sleep well. And I'll leave it at that.
Awesome. James, thanks so much for your time today, and we look forward to continuing to work with you in the future. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, James. And if anybody would like more information on James, his fund, feel free to check out his website, centeresset.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Have a great day.
The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.